videos will work before Aaron starts with his talk. So first of all, you go to my website, which you can find by using Google. Then you add SK11, capital S, capital K, 11 to the URL, and enter returns. There is also a link from the conference website. Then you see that only Monday's lectures are on, and in fact only one of them is really on, and this is Bonds. If you click on it, you get this, so complete screenshots on the right, the video on the left. And the reason I'm showing you this is because there are little links here that say add, okay? And if you click on add, it will open another tab where you can add a comment on that thing, on that which will appear on that time thing. Or alternatively, you can click right below this picture here. You know what, why don't I click it here? You click, and you can add a comment on a specific time, and then this will appear on the right. Now, to do that, you need to have an account on my wiki, because the comments go through a certain wiki. And if you want one, you have to email me to request and tell me what your preferred login name and what your email address and what your real name is. Okay, but I will. But otherwise, it's no questions asked. I mean, I do not moderate anything. I just send it. Okay. Also,
link to radiofront.com. I have.
No. if you want to jump to a specific time in Bond's talk, so say the time that he was talking about, the Fus Catalan algebra, you click on that time and it will jump there, except the internet connection is slow here, so it might actually take time to get to that point. Okay, but in principle it should work. This is the end of my story, and Aaron is the main speaker.
Thanks a lot. And after, that's just a terrifying introduction right before I speak. Now that you're going to be commenting on everything later on. So I thank the organizers. This is a fabulous place to be having a conference, and I'm very honored to be speaking here. I want to talk today about categorical representation theory. And this is really a continuation of what Michael was talking about earlier today. And in fact, most of this is, if not directly related to stuff that I'm doing with Michael, it certainly was originally Michael's idea. So I'm just going to tell you about that. And let's see. So I thought, because not everyone, this is a knot theory conference, I should start with some knot theory. This isn't a knot. So the Jones polynomial, really starts our story here. There's a way to get an invariant of tangles that you probably all know, the Jones polynomial. And the reason why, what this has to do with my story is that this one way to understand this is in terms of the representation theory of the quantum group SL2. And the way it works is you just take the defining representation of SL2 and you imagine labeling all the endpoints of this tangle by that representation. And then there's a formula for how to cook up a map between representations coming from the representation theory of UQSL2. So there, we've seen plenty of ways of thinking about it. There's also this nice Kaufman bracket approach. And that approach was categorified by Michael Kovanov to give you more than just a tangle invariant, but a two-tangle invariant. So you get given a four-dimensional surface embedded, two-dimensional surface embedded in four-dimensional space, you get a map between the respective Kovanov homologies for the different tangles. So you have this picture where, on the one hand, the Jones polynomial could be understood in terms of representation theory of quantum SL2. Then on the other hand, this has been categorified, so we found this new theory, this homology theory associated with knots. Sort of the natural question is, well, how can I fill in this picture? And What does categorified representation theory look like? The reason why one might ask that is because you might be interested in understanding categorifications of other knot invariants. So like Homfleet-PT polynomial at various specializations, Colour-Jones polynomial, these types of things can all be understood in terms of this representation theory picture. So if you want to understand sort of a unified approach to categorifying these invariants, you might be interested in, well, what is the categorification of these different quantum groups? And that's basically where the story enters. I'm not really going to talk so much about knot theory, but again, you should think of, one way to think of quantum groups is they're sort of the basic algebraic input that's underlying quantum link invariants. So categorified representation theory, or categorified quantum groups, should be the basic algebraic input that's underlying sort of this new level of structure of categorified link invariants. So I'm going to start by just reminding you about quantum SL2. This is the guy that I'm going to tell you about today, how to categorify it. We saw a little bit about this in Michael's talk. But so it's this algebra over, you know, rational functions in Q. So I'm allowed to take, I'm taking complex numbers adjoining Q, and I'm allowed to take rational functions. And we have these various relations. Sort of, it's a very simple algebra to describe in terms of generators and relations. And we're going to be looking at the representation theory of this algebra. So remember on this slide, it was all about the representations of the quantum group that were playing the key role here. So if we want to understand categorified representation theory, we want to sort of understand very well what we're starting with. So we have, you know, we're just looking at a homomorphism from this algebra into endomorphisms of V for some vector space. And one of the tricks that we always use, if you're not familiar with representation theory, at least of quantum groups, you just take K and sort of chop up this vector space into a bunch of little vector spaces corresponding to the eigenvalues of K. And so we say that K acts on a vector V by Q to the n. This is what I mean by it being an eigenvector, or a weight space, if V is in this nth weight space. So this is the way that I really think about the representation theory is, we have a bunch of vector spaces, that these are sort of how we chop them up according to the eigen spaces for the action of K. This is the relation here, saying K acts on V by Q to the n. And then we have a bunch of linear maps that take us from the nth weight space to the n plus 2 weight space. And why do those linear maps have to act that way? This is just a relation in the quantum group. So similarly, F has to take us back the other way. That's because of this relation in the quantum group. So a representation of SL2, quantum SL2, is just a bunch of vector spaces and linear maps like this, which satisfy this relation here. So the way I think about it is, if I start at Vn, I choose some vector here, and I apply E and then F, and I compare that to doing F and then E, you just get the quantum integer n times the original vector. And this is what I'll refer to throughout the talk as the SL2 relation. This is somehow the most interesting relation about SL2. I think of all these other relations as just sort of telling me that the basic structure I'm thinking about is these weight spaces with functors that hop me along in different levels. So in case you're not familiar, the quantum integer n is this rational function in Q, but you can always write it as this sort of Laurent polynomial here. Any questions? So that's sort of the review part. So now, what is categorified representation theory all about? Well, on a naive level, it's very simple. You just take that picture, and instead of saying vector spaces, I'll just say take a bunch of categories associated with these weight spaces. I'm going to have functors now, which take me from different weight spaces. And I'm going to use this notation of 1 sub n to talk about the identity functor on this category, V sub n. Before I was saying, let's take a vector V and V sub n, but I'm going to sort of use this identity functor in a way to sort of remind me what weight space I'm talking about, or weight category. I'll sort of call these all by different names, like weight space, weight category, sort of interchangeably. So we now just need to talk about what does it mean to lift that main SL2 relation. So what is this, something that some people get confused by, is what does it mean to talk about that SL2 relation on the level of functors? Well, it's not so complicated, but the trick is you just want to avoid minus signs. So I'm going to actually require my categories to have a little bit of additional structure, like being sort of additive. And what all I want is that if I look at the functor starting at the identity on, you know, V sub n, I apply the functor E then the functor F, and I compare that with applying F and then E, then I get that this functor is isomorphic to that one, direct sum with a bunch of copies of the identity. And when I write direct sum over a quantum integer n, so like quantum 2 is q squared plus 1 plus q to the minus 2, if I write direct sum over quantum integer 2, 1 sub n, what I mean by that...
Is that quantum 3?
Oh, sorry, please. Thank you. Quantum 3, what I really mean by that is I want you to take the direct sum of this with itself 3 times, but sort of shift the grading. So I guess I was sweeping under the rug a little bit that I want these categories to carry some additional structure of a grading. So this would be 1 sub n shifted by 0 plus 1 sub n shifted by minus 2. So I was sort of not being completely explicit about all the structure I want these categories to have, but it should be enough to where this sort of makes sense. And notice that because I don't want to have minus signs, when n is negative, that's when n is negative, like it says there, I'm sort of switching the relation and writing it the other way. So this is what I mean by a sort of categorical representation of a quantum. So in many ways, we haven't done anything very exciting. We just sort of took an ordinary representation and thought of it sort of categorically. So there's an example for those that like geometry. There's a really nice example coming from partial flag varieties. So if I look at the Grassmannian of k-planes in some fixed n-dimensional space, and I consider this partial flag variety where I have a k-plane inside of a k+1 plane inside of a big n space, well, there's two obvious forgetful maps which take me, you know, where I forget one of the two planes that take me back to these different Grassmannians. So when I look on the cohomology, I get these inclusions of the cohomology of the Grassmannian of k-planes and the cohomology of the Grassmannian of k+1 planes. I can use these to define a bimodule. So the cohomology of this big variety becomes a bimodule of the cohomology of these. And you sort of get this big categorical representation by considering categories of modules over these Grassmannians. These are the categories associated with the Grassmannians. Sorry?
It's a modules over cohomology of the Grassmannians.
Yeah, modules over the cohomology rings of Grassmannians. So here I'm just writing HK, but really I mean the category of modules over the cohomology of the Grassmannian. This is just a very simple example. There's much more exciting examples in geometry. This is just a very sort of simple one where, like I say, the categories for weight spaces are these modules over the cohomology of a Grassmannian. And how do I get from one category to another category? This is k+1. I tensor with this bimodule coming from the partial flag variety. So this isn't meant to be like a very detailed, I can spend maybe like an hour telling you about this. It's just meant to say that, you know, there's lots of examples that come from geometry, and typically, here's one very nice example. Just to give you sort of a little bit of the flavor of these things. So if you take this analogy with the Jones polynomial and Kolmogorov homology very seriously, then you would expect that this categorified representation theory should have some new structure, some new level of interesting interactions. So I sort of think of this picture as sort of how things get more exciting. Is before we had tangles, now we have tangle cobordisms. So what's the higher level structure of categorified representation theory? And the answer to that is, if we look at these representations where we have categories associated to weight spaces, then what we should be doing is looking at the natural transformations that go between the functors. So this is where we're going to see the extra level. So for the quantum group SL2, we couldn't talk about having maps going from E to E, you know, these generators E to itself. But if I talk about a functor E, there's a natural candidate for a map going between functors. It's called a natural transformation. So what we do is we want to look at this structure of natural transformations and understand it to look at what the next level of representation theory should look like. And one of the sort of main things that we should require is that those SL2 relations, the ones about EF and FE, those should not be imposed anymore. These should follow from the new level of structure. So we should have this structure of natural transformations, maybe some interesting relations at that level, which imply the SL2 relations. So all these known quantum groups should be sort of seen as a shadow of this newer theory. So that's what we're going for. And by studying the structure of those natural transformations and using some hints from geometric representation theory, we can categorify the quantum group. And let me just say, it's organized in the structure of a two category. But if you don't like to think about it, the way, I mean, what do I think of as a two-category? It's just a world where you can draw planar pictures. The regions are the objects of this two-category. The sort of endpoints of arrows are like one morphisms, and a picture gives you a two morphism. So you can think of these pictures as representing natural transformations. So, you know, what are my objects? They're the weights of SL2. A one morphism is a bunch of E's and F's. And notice I'm allowing myself to have a grading shift here. This is just to get the quantum group into the game. The Q is somehow being encoded by this grading shift. And then we just have some generating pictures. So you don't ever have to say two category if you don't like that language, but it sort of gives you a nice way to think about it. So I'm reading these pictures from right to left and bottom to top. So remember, E is a one morphism which goes from the weight N to N plus 2. And I'm saying we need to introduce a new higher level morphism, something going from an E to an E. And my grading conventions are such that this picture has degree 2. So if you see a shift here, it's telling you what the degree of that map is. So this is a picture going from E to E. So it's a 2 morphism or a natural transformation in those examples we were looking at. So here I'm saying that you should add a crossing, which can be thought of as a 2 morphism going from E composed with E into E composed with E, and this has degree minus 2, as it says right here. Just like it also says right here. And what's interesting, so if you look at this calculus just with the upward strands, notice I'm not labeling every single region because it would get a little bit tiring, but you should remember that each time you cross an upward pointing strand, you're increasing the weight by 2. And if you cross a downward pointing strand, you're decreasing the weight by 2. So crossing this downward strand from N goes to N minus 2. And over here in the far left of this picture would be N minus 4, right? Because we crossed 2 Fs.
And what's the dot do?
The dot is just, it's just saying we're having some new map. So there's sort of several motivations for where it comes from. On the one hand, there's this this bilinear form that Michael talked about. We sort of built this two category so that it would have that, it would match up with this bilinear form, like the graded dimensions. Another way to think about it is, if you really like geometry, is if you look at this, E is supposed to be this bimodule coming from tensoring with this partial flag variety. Well, there's a natural bimodule map from this thing to itself given by tensoring with the Chern class of this line bundle here. So the dot is really multiplication by that line bundle, or the Chern class of that line bundle. But I mean, there's sort of several ways of thinking about it. But the most naive way of thinking about it is it's just some new structure we're adding, we're throwing it in. So this is the same picture that Michael was drawing in his talk. He was just allowing his strands to have different colors, like I, J for the vertex set. Here we're working with a graph that's a little bit boring. Our graph gamma just looks like this, one node, and we just have a single color I. So these are much like the ones that we saw in Michael's talk. So we're throwing in these new two morphisms, and then we're going to impose some relations. So one of the relations are sort of the planar algebra condition. It's sort of saying, well, not as we heard, there's a slight distinction here, which is that I'm forcing my, you know, a sense of source and target here. But what it's really saying is that these guys are giving you a planar algebra. You can sort of deform the pictures in any way that you like, and you still get the same two morphism. So these are equations between composites of two morphisms in this two category. But if you like, you can just think of them as diagrammatic relations. So if you're used to working with sort of diagrammatic algebras, this should be, you know, not too different. The only important thing to note is that all of the regions carry a label. They're colored by these different weights of SL2. And we're allowed to bend these strings around in any way that we like, and we get the same two morphisms.
Could you put your slide to define coming
down? What? Yeah, here.
Oh, okay.
And notice that they have a degree which depends on n.
Yeah.
So if you look at these things, it's actually a little bit of a computation. So this cup has degree 1 plus n, and this cap has degree 1 minus whatever the weight is, which is n plus 2, which if you add that up, it happens to be 0, which is the same as the degree of this map. So everything here is preserving the grading, but it's maybe a little bit of work to check that. Okay, here's where they maybe become more less obvious, the relations. So this first one, forget about these bubbles for a second. Let's look at this Nil-Hecker relations. These were what Michael was drawing on the board earlier. He said you have Rademeister move, and this double crossing is zero when the colors have the same strand. There's some way of sliding dots through crossings, but when you do that, you pick up some identities. This is the sort of the key structure if you were interested in only categorifying U plus. So those were the key relations which gave you a categorification of U plus. So you can think of this topological invariance or this cap and cup as sort of taking what Michael said and adding to it, what Fs do and sort of the compatibility between the Fs. So the next condition, which is not completely obvious, so where do these come from is a natural question. One place where they come from is these are very natural in the context of these Grassmannians. If you look at the E's that I was talking about there and the relations among them, this algebra very naturally acts. But we find that it's a much more general phenomenon. And also, these are key relations in actually showing that we categorify the quantum group, that we really do get a lifting of that structure. So this one is something that's sort of controlling the size of our homes. What it's saying is that if I look at a map that goes from n to n, or let's say a closed diagram in a region labeled n, you could imagine that we could build all sorts of crazy composites out of these crossings and dots, just build all sorts of wild diagrams. Well, this condition says that the most basic of those closed diagrams, the ones that I can make just using a cap, a cup, and some dots, that if those diagrams have negative degree, we want to make those diagrams zero. And one of the motivations for this is that you can imagine that if I was allowed to have a lot of negative degree diagrams, then the space of Homs in any fixed degree, you could make it infinite dimensional by, repeatedly composing with this negative degree guy and some positive degree guys. You could make it sort of infinite dimensional. So this is somehow controlling the size of the Homs. It's saying that, you just do a simple degree computation with those degrees that I wrote down earlier. You see that it has this degree, so you just impose that these bubbles are zero when they're negative degree. And again, one motivation for this is just that it keeps the size of your homes controllable. Another motivation for this is that when you look at that example of the cohomology rings, these bimodule maps are always zero when they're in negative degree. And the final relation just says that we categorify this relation. So I'm going to do this isomorphism here. So remember, I'm supposed to have that EF is isomorphic to this big direct sum. So how do I construct an isomorphism? Well, all I have is these new two morphisms that I threw in. I have these diagrammatic generators. So there's a natural map going from FE1 sub n into EF1 sub n, which is that sideways crossing. And you might protest that earlier on I never really defined a sideways crossing, I just defined vertical crossings. But because we have this sort of planar condition, I can take this vertical crossing and bend one of the sides around. And if you look at this, now it's going from down up into up down. So I can sort of define my sideways crossing in this way. And you could also do it the other way, and the condition says that this will always be the same. Let's see if I can manage to do this one right. Whatever one you think it's going to be. Maybe like that. Down, up. Perfect. So either of these two definitions, they both agree, and they give you the same definition of the sideways crossing. And then if you look at the sort of those degree shifts which are showing up in this direct sum, they're perfect for having a cup be a map from here into here, and then adding various numbers of dots to them, I get maps which go from each of these shifts. So there's a very natural candidate for a map which goes from one side of the SLT relations to the other side of the SLT relations. And all we're going to do is say that this map is an isomorphism, and it has an inverse which looks like that. So on the one hand, it's sort of the most obvious thing. Here it's getting a little bit more complicated, like I'm taking some kind of combination of cups with bubbles. But from, again, computations in Grassmannians and from some other if you took sort of the most general inverse that this map could have, it turns out it really has to be that map. So this is the most general inverse that you could have up to isomorphism. And that's what the two categories defined as. So we have this topological invariance, Neel-Heck algebra axioms, a condition about negative Homs, and the fact that this map is an isomorphism. So you can work out what that means. So we have, this condition about the zigzags, the topological invariance, this is what Michael is referring to as being bi-adjoint. So if we say it in algebraic language, having E and F with these caps and cuffs and being able to have these zigzags, that's just saying that E and F are bi-adjoint up to gradient shift. And then in this more algebraic language again, we also say that it's cyclic with respect to the bi-adjoint structure, and this is even less universal. Some people say things like, if this was a monoidal category, they would call it maybe pivotal. But we're talking about a two-category, so maybe it's some kind of a pivotal two-category. The point is that you can wiggle the pictures around and get the same thing. Here, I'm calling that cyclic. We have this Neel-Heck algebra action, negative three bubbles, and this isomorphism. And if you want more concrete relations, like maybe you want to know exactly what I have to check in order to know that that map is the inverse, the relations look like this. And, you know, I don't always show them because they're a little bit ugly, but one key feature here, the relations depend on the weight. But I guess that should be sort of obvious, right? That if we want to have something that acts like SL2, the SL2 relations depend on what weight space you're in. You know, when I do EF and then FE, I get the direct sum of quantum N copies of the identity, where N was the weight space. So in this case, when N is bigger than 0, this right twist curl is equal to 0. And this left twist curl is something more complicated involving bubbles. And similarly, you have some weird version of Rademeister 2 with a minus sign when you do the Rademeister move this way. If you're doing it the other way, you get some ugly combination of bubbles. And when N is 0, you can sort of pull them apart with a minus sign. So these are the exact relations that you have to check. And what do you get with all this stuff? That's the key. I mean, I just sort of threw these definitions up without much motivation. Well, the reason that this is the right answer is because if I take the Grothendieck ring of this category, so I'm imposing a relation that says whenever I have a direct sum of one morphisms, x and y, then I impose this relation, symbol of x plus symbol of y, in the Grothendieck ring. So let me just say that the Grothendieck ring of this two category is generated by symbols of one morphisms, so isomorphism classes of symbols of one morphisms, where I impose this relation whenever I have a direct sum, and whenever I have a gradient shift, I switch that to multiplication by Q. And if we look at what this structure has, then this two category that I've defined has its Grothendieck ring exactly isomorphic to this quantum SL2. And I have to throw in a little bit of sort of conditions here. I'm really working with an integral version of the quantum group where we look at Lustig's. I'm looking at Lustig's U dot here. So first off, I'm looking at the integral version of that. And what I've done is I've replaced 1 by a copy of mutually orthogonal idempotents, 1 sub n. Absolutely. This is Lustig's, and usually I call it Lustig's U dot. This time I was going a little bit quicker. So this version of the algebra was introduced by Lustig, and that's where the canonical basis comes from. In his setting, they're working geometrically, but one of the things that we find in this picture is that we're getting a basis in the Grothendieck ring given by the one morphisms which are indecomposable. So it's natural that this Grothendieck ring, you know, it's generated by these symbols of one morphisms. Well, you're going to get a basis given by those one morphisms that don't decompose anymore. So we're getting a basis in this diagrammatic picture given by the indecomposable one morphisms, and you can show that this is exactly the same as the basis that Lustig has for U dot. So but one of the interesting things is that we're getting this very nice basis with these special, you know, positivity properties without using any perverse sheaves or, you know, sophisticated geometric constructions. This, as I mentioned, was sort of designed so that the graded Homs in this category categorifies the semilinear form due to Lustig. And that example I showed you, you might wonder, these relations I showed you were a little bit wild, and maybe it was very hard to construct in examples, but you can actually construct analogs of these crossings and dots and those geometric examples and check those relations that I showed you to show that you're getting an action of this two category. And, one thing that I didn't really stress was that in this two category, we're allowed to take k linear combinations of these diagrams. So given a one morphism and another one morphism, what does a most general two morphism look like? It's just a linear combination of these pictures that go from the right source to the right target. Well, if you take k linear combinations of pictures, you'll get a vector space of maps from one to the other. It turns out that this result is also true if you just take z linear combinations of two morphisms, so that your Hom spaces are not actually k vector spaces, they're just abelian groups. And this involves constructing some explicit decompositions for the higher relations in U dot. This was done with Kovanov and Marco Mackay and Marco Stosch.
Is that for SL2 or for general?
That is only for SL2. That's right. So this result here, I should mention about constructing a two category which categorifies Lustig's U dot. So that's true for, Michael and I proved it for SLN. So we defined a two category by sort of taking that category for U plus and kind of combining it with these SL2s. That gave us a proposed categorification of U for SLN. And we sort of conjectured that this would be a categorification more generally. And this is stated in Webster's recent work that that's true. So there may be a categorification for all symmetrizable Casimir algebras. Okay. So let me just get back to this higher structure of representation theory. So I sort of went on a detour, right? At the beginning I said we were interested in representations of quantum SL2, but then I started telling you how to categorify quantum SL2. This is supposed to be telling you what is the higher level structure that you should be looking for, and sort of the way that you make that precise is just to say that a two representation, instead of being a collection of categories and functors satisfying certain relations, well, it's a collection of categories, functors, and natural transformations that all satisfy those relations that we define. So if you're interested in the higher representation theory, a key ingredient is going to be these generating two morphisms and proving those relations between them. So the way we formalize this is just to say that it's a two functor from this two category U into a two category. Nothing much. So the practical among you, or especially those that are interested in geometric representation theory, might have the following question. Do you really have to check all those relations? If you look at this definition I gave you, I mean, these things don't look like they're easy to kind of thing to do. I mean, if you're working in derived categories of coherent sheaves on some Lustig quiver varieties, you're defining this adjoint map in the dot, and you're composing it with this map in the dot. I mean, this isn't the kind of thing that you're going to be able to compare these natural transformations so directly. So the question is, do you really have to check all those relations? And it turns out if you're studying categorifications of finite dimensional representations, you don't. It's enough just to check that these functors are bi-adjoint. So as long as you know that E's and F's have those zigzag rules, if you know that the nil-Heck algebra is acting, so you have those crossings and relations that I showed you for those, and this condition about the finite dimensionality, that's actually, which in most geometric examples is very trivial to check, but from the perspective of this diagrammatic construction, you really need this to be true, that you don't have these negative degree closed diagrams, because if you did, you could always just compose with those and get really big homes. So it turns out if you have all of these, just these conditions, and you're working in a finite dimensional representation, so you're categorifying some finite dimensional rep, then that's all you have to check.
Do you think that the requirements on the final dimension is conditioned on K0, this category, or is it...
That's right. I'm basically assuming that there's finitely many categories here. That's right. I think it would be more sophisticated if it was like you could have infinite categories, but their K0s were 0 or something. What did I want to say about this? I mean, this result is a little bit surprising because so this is with Simon Cowdes, by the way, I should mention. One of the things that you could imagine is that I have this two representation, and somehow I know that these SL2 relations hold. So I know I have these isomorphisms for SL2 relations. Why on earth do those isomorphisms have to be those crazy ones that I showed you, the ones that we required for this two category. Well, it's actually a thing. I mean, you can prove this. You sort of build it up using this fact about the Homs and using bi-adjointness quite a bit. You can actually show that whenever the SL2 relations hold in this categorical setting, they have to be that one. So that sort of says that, you know, if you're working this, you don't have to spend so much time checking that. And so then you might ask the question, well, okay, if much of this structure of categorified representation theory we don't have to check, why did you bother telling me all those horrible relations? You know, what are those going to do for me? And that's, I mean, that's a really good question. And the answer is that these higher relations, this higher structure that I told you about, it's really where all the interesting results are. I mean, this is where we're seeing new structure that wasn't present with just ordinary quantum groups. So this is the place where you should look when you want to generalize, find new structure. Remember, if you think about Kolmogorov homology as the as a sort of analogy, before we just had tangles, now we have some sort of tangle coordinates. We want to see this new level of structure in this category, in this quantum group setting. So one of the early applications of this categorification story was due to Chuang and Routier. And one of the things they did with this was they showed that if ever you've constructed a categorified representation, so I have a bunch of categories here, and I have these functors E and F, well, I'll say it in a sort of more modern way, and you have this nil-heck algebra action, what you can do is you can use that structure to construct equivalences which go from this category to this category. So if you're in the business of trying to construct equivalences between categories, one of the ways that you can do that is to construct an action of categorified SL2, use that structure to construct the derived equivalence. So you get that for free. As soon as you have the SL2 action, you get these derived equivalences. And this was used by Chuang and Routier to prove an important result for symmetric groups called the abelian defect conjecture. So this is like a very down-to-earth, you know, this is like modular representation theory of the symmetric group. So they're proving a theorem about symmetric groups using categorification of SL2. So Chuang and Routier were initially working with a slightly different algebra, and they were more interested in sort of non-quantum group type things. Kautis, Chemnitzer, and Makata sort of redid this in the graded setting and in a more general setting of triangulated categories. So this in their work, they were interested in constructing derived equivalences between coherent sheaves on these cotangent bundles of Grassmannians, and so there they also used this construction. But the idea actually goes back to Chuang and Routier. So that's one reason why you should care about this higher structure. And more generally, this is like a, you can think of this somehow like a twist going from one weight space to the other. If you construct these same maps in SLN setting, you actually get braid group actions as opposed to just, you know, equivalences. So in fact, the Kautis, Chemnitzer, and Lakata use it to get derived braid group actions on derived categories. Another thing that you can do is, I mean, like I say, if you want to categorify any sort of representation theoretic construction, you can use this higher structure, and it always plays somehow a key role. So I just want to sort of hint at this work with Anna Belyakova and Michael Kovanov, where we gave a categorification of the Casimir element. So this Casimir element for Lustig Udot is a little bit weird because you have a bunch of different terms, one for each end. But the element looks like this, and this element is sort of characterized by generating the center. So if you want to understand the center of the quantum group, you just need to know about this Casimir. And if you look at this formula, it looks a little bit crazy if you were going to try and categorify it. But when you organize it in the right way into a complex, the fact that these maps have to have the right degree, like this 1 minus n is exactly the degree of this cup. So you're able to build this complex in sort of a nice way. And one of the things we could show using, again, extensively using all of those higher relations that I showed you, is that this element, you know, well, okay, this is sort of obvious that it categorifies the Casimir, because if you match the terms here with the terms you see here, you see that it's obviously going to have the right growth in the ring. The minus signs, anything with a minus sign is in odd homological degree. Anything with a plus sign is in even homological degree. So it's obvious that it's going to categorify the Casimir. What's not so obvious is that this complex now is in the center of this more generalized setting, meaning that this complex commutes with all other complexes of diagrams that I can draw in this two-category, up to chain homotopy. And, you know, we can actually write down these chain homotopies and things like that. So, all this was meant to do is just to indicate that if you want to start categorifying other representation theoretic constructions, it's somehow having all of this higher structure around is going to be relevant. And I just want to end with one more example, which is a little bit surprising, is that these relations that I wrote down, those strange things about Rademeister 1-like moves and Rademeister 2-type moves, they seem to have some surprising connections to symmetric functions, in particular, sort of explicit combinatorics that holds for symmetric functions. So I just want to tell you a little bit about that, which requires me to remind you of a few facts. So the ring of symmetric functions has various bases. One is sort of as algebraic bases. So in particular, I can take the elementary symmetric functions, which I can tell you the definition if you like. I find these examples a little bit easier. So there's the elementary and there's the complete. And in the complete, you get things like x1 squared, x2 squared. You don't have those in the elementary. So there's these two different algebraic bases for the ring of symmetric functions. And if you want to know how these two are related, well, there's this formula saying if I take the sum, then this is how the two are related. So both of these provide a basis for this ring. So you can think of the ring as this infinite polynomial ring in either of these two variables. Well, one of the things you can show using those relations that I showed you is that if we took any crazy complicated diagram that's closed, so going from, you know, end to end, well, you can always reduce those crazy diagrams to just products of non-nested bubbles with some number of dots. And I've written it so that the degree R is present, you know, is sort of obvious here. Remember, these caps and cups have funny degrees which depend on n, so I'm writing it in this way so you can see easily what the degree is. So because everything can be reduced to these dotted bubbles, and we know that negative degree dotted bubbles are zero, and you can also show that products of these non-nested dotted bubbles are never zero, there's no relations among them, you actually get an isomorphism between the ring of symmetric functions and the space of maps from one end to one end, just given by these closed diagrams. And you might say, well, okay, that's if I took one orientation. Well, what happens if I took this other orientation? Well, the way that these two different orientations are related is exactly by this relationship between elementary and complete. Now, I don't claim that that's terribly exciting. I mean, it's just the fact that the counterclockwise dotted bubbles are related to the clockwise dotted bubbles by this formula. So that's not terribly exciting. But one thing that is a little bit interesting is that we can start to identify other natural diagrams in the calculus. And these diagrams start to look like power sum symmetric functions. Or this one is just, you just put a degree R bubble inside of a degree zero bubble, and then use the relations to simplify this and rewrite it in terms of, and what you get is exactly the power sum symmetric function written in terms of the elementary symmetric function. Okay, that's kind of cute. I mean, what's, you know, it just goes on and on, though. If you take this natural diagram given by, well, here it's a little bit obvious to see how this generalizes, but in general, what you take is the longest braid word, and you put a certain number of dots here, and label these by lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, and you simplify these more complicated diagrams. What you're getting is exactly the formula which expresses the Schur polynomials, these are some other interesting symmetric functions, in terms of elementary symmetric functions. So the combinatorics of these higher relations that depend on the weights in these intricate ways somehow is telling you something about the Jacobi-Trudy formula for writing a Schur polynomial in terms of elementary symmetric functions. So this hasn't been explored too much, but it's sort of a little bit surprising that you can encode all of these, or a lot of this combinatorics of symmetric functions in terms of these higher relations on two morphisms. Which again, that was by no means part of the structure. We didn't intend for that to be, it wasn't sort of built that way. It's just a consequence of this relationship with SL2. So
what's surprising we put in the middle? What generalizes the clustering
though? Here?
Yes.
It's this. You take like the longest braid word, and then you close this thing off. So in general, if you want to categorify, or if you want to look at S lambda 1, sorry, S lambda, where lambda is a partition, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, so however many it is, take the longest braid word on M strands, so I've drawn it here for M equals 4, and then there's a little bit of a normalization factor, which is to do with the fact that these bubbles have this little normalization factor. But you put this normalization factor in, and you put lambda 1, lambda 2, and you reduce this, and what you get is a bunch of weird combinations of dotted bubbles. But what is that weird combination of dotted bubbles? It's exactly the Jacobi-Churdy formula for the shirt bubble.
See,
that's
really
stuff. What's
that?
No, no. Oh, I'm all done, so go ahead. That's all I wanted to say.
So what is the formula for H3?
For the complete?
Yeah.
So in terms of these, or so one is the counterclockwise bubble, and one is the clockwise bubble. So an elementary, I mean, it's sort of an arbitrary choice, but an elementary is like a clockwise-oriented bubble of degree R, and a complete is like the counterclockwise-oriented bubble of degree R.